Hi, I'm Michael Rappaport.
And I'm Kibi Rappaport.
And together we're hosting Rappaport's Reality Podcast.
We have a passion for reality TV, and we're inviting you into our living room.
We're talking tea, we're dissecting the drama, and we're giving praise to the single greatest form of entertainment on television today. That is right. Reality TV is the greatest form of entertainment on television today.
Here are some examples of what you'll hear from us on Rappaport's Reality Podcast.
This is where we discuss all things reality TV, all things popular culture.
And a little bit of Rappaport's reality, the reality of us.
We're figuring out. And if we had been recording these last 4 or 5 days, it would have been
juicy.
The podcast would have taken a left turn.
Listen to Rappaport's Reality with me, Kibi Rappaport.
And me, Michael Rappaport, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcast.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season one, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do. Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season one, like my producer, Anna.
Oh, my God.
My friend, Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the deputy medical examiner.
And of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure, it kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What?
I can't believe this.
Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV true crime podcast, To Live and Die in LA. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world, and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but...
same old us. Oh, yeah.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Hi, hello there, and welcome to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby,
I am your host, Liv, who is slowly becoming a regular human once more. I think that Tuesday's episode will be possible because I think, so far, my brain works again. But today, I am here with another wonderful conversation episode that I recorded a while back. You can tell because I mentioned Seneca's Medea, so that's how long ago we recorded this, but I am so excited to finally be sharing it with you. I spoke with the author, Sophia Kouidou-Giles, who has not only written a new book featuring none other than Circe and a fascinatingly fictionalized Scylla, but who is also herself Greek. Sophia will not be the last Greek person I talk to about writing Greek myth retellings. It's been an effort of mine whenever possible to get Greek people on the show who are writing this stuff because I think that we need more of them bringing in their heritage to this saturated genre, and I'm so excited to see more of them. I also just spoke with somebody yesterday whose episode will be coming out in a little bit. So we're piling that up, and it is such a thrill. But Sophia was just so absolutely lovely to speak to. We just talked about her book, absolutely, but also just about the mythology surrounding the Odyssey and Circe and the Greek landscape and writing these kinds of stories and Greece itself. It was just an absolutely lovely conversation, so I am just generally so excited to share it all with you. Plus, I have to tell you that a highlight is the lovely Sophia just proclaiming that Zeus is a sex maniac. So you do have that to look forward to. It was a joy. Conversations, giving Circe the agency she deserves. An unexpected ally with Sophia Kouidou-Giles. You've written this novel, but I know you have a background, you know, in Greek everything, and you yourself are Greek. So why don't you tell me first a little bit about yourself and, you know, what you do as a writer, everything like that?
Yeah, well, you know, I had a career in social services, but once I retired, that was the opportunity to fall back into what I used to love to do. And we are talking back grade school and high school and those years, you know. But what happened is I came to the United States right after high school and had to cope with adjusting, you know, studying, getting the vocabulary, getting into a profession, finishing a career before I could really relax and fall back into reading and writing. That is the story of an immigrant, really, that falls in love back to my own heritage. That was the unique thing and the pleasure I get out of writing and dealing with myths.
Yeah, that's so wonderful. I mean, it's an interesting thing in my position because I don't, you know, myth, like you said, mythology is a huge genre right now, and there are so many retellings coming out all the time. But it's very rare that those retellings are actually written by someone with Greek heritage, you know, let alone an immigrant from Greece. And so it's so exciting to have that. There's a few more now, though. You're the first of what I think will be a few Greek authors on my show talking about their retellings, which is very exciting.
Excellent.
Yeah. So you just kind of fell back into mythology. So, you know, your book, An Unexpected Ally, it's about Circe, right? And Scylla. But I would love to hear, like, what did you read that then made you go, oh, I want to write this novel about these two?
Well, you know, I was reading Homer, and it was Homer that, you know, introduces the idea of Scylla. We say Scylla in Greek, not Scylla.
Oh, I say Scylla. No, yeah.
Oh, good.
I know where I mean, I'm not great at Greek, I will say, but I definitely know there's no silent K or C in there.
You've got it. Yes, yes. So when I was reading that, I thought I could do a story that starts at the end of this relationship with Odysseus. And that's what got me inspired, if you will, you know, endings of relationships and beginnings of relationships. And it ended up being sort of the theme of the book in some ways. So then I thought, well, what was it about this relationship that ended? Because she's a powerful witch, sorceress. She could have kept him there, you know, if she wanted to, a little more potion, some other magic and so forth. And I thought, you know, in our lives as adults, we experience endings of all sorts. And that is a theme that I can elaborate by starting my story there. So that was the beginning.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, I love the Odyssey. It's my favorite, you know, ancient Greek epic, let alone probably my favorite ancient Greek text, period. Though I do love Euripides. The Odyssey is so amazing. And you're right about Circe. It's so interesting. And I should say, I'm sorry, I don't say Circe. I probably should, but everyone knows her as Circe in English. But I do know that in Greek, it's Circe. So you feel free to pronounce it however you want. But, and I like to tell my listeners that it is Circe, but it just, you know, anyway, it's interesting. Like you say, she could have kept him there because it's such a good an example that Calypso kept him when she wanted to, and Circe didn't. And that's really an interesting thing about their story specifically in comparison to Calypso.
So, you know, that is the cool thing about working with myths. Is we can give it a complexity that was not presented or intended. I mean, Homer was not writing about women heroines. He was writing about war, about heroes, about deeds and that sort of thing. So she did play a role in his story, but it was a secondary role. So I was thinking, well, this is a woman that I want to have a lot more agency. I wanted her to realize that Odysseus is already traveling back home. His heart is not hers anymore. So the heck with him. That's how the story starts, you know. All right, let's see him off, you know, and do a number of things as a farewell sort of gestures. And after that, I'm on to the next thing.
Mm-hmm.
And well, I'm not going to give you a lot of hints about...
No, we don't want to spoil it. But I am so interested in how you wanted to handle Scylla as a character, because of course in the Odyssey we really just hear about her as this, you know, monster who's going to cause all this trouble for Odysseus and his ship. But then we have this background for her, which, you know, as far as I know, is found almost only in Ovid's Metamorphoses, I think, right? This idea that she, you know, was kind of cursed, or she, you know, started out as a nymph or a human, but that she was transformed into the monster that she became. So how did you want to handle that? And, you know, what kind of sources were you reading? Did you read a lot of Ovid, any of that?
I've read Ovid and I use Ovid again in my next book. But here I took a lot of liberties. I did not stick to the original, you know, authors and sources. I wanted her to be a young, innocent girl. And I decided she was going to live on this Greek island that was known for all the temples. It was the birthplace of Apollo. And she was a young woman whose mother had passed on. And she was just living her life. But she meets Circe. And things happen there. So we have a relationship that establishes between the two women, a friendly kind of relationship. So Circe now takes an interest in following what happens to this young girl as the story goes on. And I'm going to go dot, dot, dot again. So you see, the setting of the meeting is very different. It's an innocent, youthful young lady that happens to come across a goddess, a powerful goddess.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. That's very exciting. I mean, my show is really, as much as possible, it's about talking about women in Greek myth. Because they didn't get enough attention back in the day.
Yes.
Yeah. So, you know, I just love all of the women characters of Greek myth, but Circe is one of my favorites by far. But, you know, you mentioned this island. So she's on Delos, right? How did you want to write Delos? Like, I've been there a couple of times. It's amazing. But I can only imagine what it would have looked like in the ancient world.
This was sheer imagination on my part. I have not traveled to Delos, although I go back to Greece, but it is a place I'm going to go to one way or another. So I investigated it really through photography, through words from friends that had gone and visited. And I created a map, you know, in my mind, where I could see the port, I could see that people would climb up to the propylaea and then move into the temples. I could see the temple of Apollo. You know, I could see the priests. I could see the lineup of merchants that were selling goods for the temples, for the sacrifices. So that was just part of the pleasure of putting things together, you know, and navigating my people, my protagonist, and all the rest of them up and down the island. Yeah.
Yeah. That's wonderful. I mean, Delos is an amazing island, but yeah, imagining it in the ancient world, there's just so much there because it was so sacred. So it's really interesting that you wanted to use an island that is so devoted to the gods, but have it be just like a place that a young woman is growing up. Like, did you want to kind of use that as I don't even know what I want to ask, but you know, how did you want her life to be involved with all of the, you know, the divine nature of Delos, the way that it's so much more connected to the gods than any other island?
Yeah, it was a girl that lived in a village. She was not in the capital, so to speak, but the lineage is what leads us to the temples. She had a relative. She had that kind of a connection. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the story, you will see that she has a future in the temples. So what a better island than, you know, Delos.
Yeah. Oh, that's wonderful. I go to Greece probably too often for my finances, but it's just the most amazing place. And Delos is certainly high up there. Yeah.
Yeah. I personally was born in Thessaloniki. I don't know if you've been up there.
I haven't yet, unfortunately. It's on my list.
Yes. Yeah, you should. Yeah. There's a lot of atmosphere, more, you know, the Roman and the Byzantine evidence in that city, but definitely a sense of history. The location is prime. So I'm proud to be from Salonika, but I love traveling to the islands when I can.
Yes, I mean, that's a problem. That's why I haven't gone up north very much, because every time I go, I just want to go back to the islands. Naxos is my favorite. It's just so beautiful. So when it comes to Circe, she's such an interesting character because, you know, she is this witch in the Odyssey, but we don't really get like a ton of information about how she uses her witchcraft. Obviously, she transforms Odysseus's men into pigs and then back again. And, you know, but we don't get like main, you know, kind of descriptions of her magic. How did you, like, Did you want to make her super magical? Is she like a big witch goddess in your book, or is she more of that goddess side of her? She just is so complex. You could do so many things.
Yeah, no, I gave her a lot of powers in this.
Good.
There was even shape-shifting, you know. So there is a little bit of the magic and the exaggerated power. But I think I tried to keep her very human in spirit, in the way she connects and cares and investigates things. And, you know, she pays attention to what the 12 Olympians are doing, but they are sort of up on the clouds there, and she doesn't always agree with them. She has agency. She really has agency.
Yeah. I mean, good. I would think, you know, Cersei would not normally agree with the Olympians. They're usually making poor decisions. So did you include other gods in the story, or did you kind of want to keep the rest of them separate?
No. They mingle. They cause trouble. They have opinions. Yes, definitely.
Good.
Definitely.
That's one thing that I often find, I think, is for me, is lacking in a lot of the retellings lately, is they really focus on that more human aspect, which is perfect and interesting, you know. But what I love about Greek mythology over other mythologies that I've encountered is the way that the gods are really human in really interesting ways, and the way they, like, you know, screw things up, and the way they make all these mistakes, and they make everything kind of messy. It's so much more interesting than when a god is just kind of like off in the ether, you know, sort of unseen. Like, I'd much rather have what it sounds like you're doing, which is like having them involved, because in the myths themselves, they're so involved.
Yes. Well, the advantage of writing, you know, and using mythology is that you get a fundamental cast of that character. You know, Zeus is known for his thunderbolts, right? Aphrodite for her erotic prowess, you know, Ares for being out for war and trouble, you know. So you have a beginning place, but after that you can go to town and create all sorts of things, you know.
Hi, I'm Michael Rappaport.
And I'm Kibi Rappaport.
And together we're hosting Rappaport's Reality Podcast.
We have a passion for reality TV, and we're inviting you into our living room.
We're talking tea, we're dissecting the drama, and we're giving praise to the single greatest form of entertainment on television today. That is right. Reality TV is the greatest form of entertainment on television today.
Here are some examples of what you'll hear from us on Rappaport's Reality Podcast.
This is where we discuss all things reality TV, all things popular culture.
And a little bit of Rappaport's reality, the reality of us.
We're figuring out. And if we had been recording these last 4 or 5 days, it would have been
juicy.
The podcast
juicy.
Would have taken a left turn.
Listen to Rappaport's Reality with me, Kibi Rappaport.
And me, Michael Rappaport, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcast.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season one, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do. Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season one, like my producer, Anna.
Oh, my God.
My friend, Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the deputy medical examiner.
And of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure, it kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What?
I can't believe this.
Listen to season 2 of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV True Crime Podcast, To Live and Die in LA. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene!
Eugene Fodor!
Gene, was booted!
Much of the joy you will find on the road comes from the person you share it with.
So you write the books, Gene, and Vlastar on the business. I understand now. It's a wise man who marries a wiser woman.
But be careful and choose your travel partner well, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
Get down!
I'm not stupid, Gene. Something is going on, and it's high time you tell me the truth.
Freeze, Americano!
Gene, run!
So travel before it's too late. Your money will return, your time won't, and we're all too quickly approaching that final destination.
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And I think you're going to like my second book, which is not published yet. It's getting out in 25. Where the gods and their point of view becomes very important.
That's very exciting. Yeah. Can you say what that is, what the book is about? Do you have specific characters you're talking about?
Yes. I have a prime character there too. And that happens to be Circe's mother. There is a linkage from one book to the next.
Yes.
And, you know, again, Percy is not a character that we know a lot about. That was permission for me to create a mother-daughter thing. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Her mother is, you know, she's barely ever talked about in any sources. That's very right. Exciting. Yeah. I have a real love for that family because I also find Medea to be one of the most interesting of all Greek mythological women for so many reasons.
Yes.
I'm currently reading. I rarely ever look into Roman literature because I just don't care about Rome all that much. But I'm currently reading Seneca's Medea, which is kind of selling me on maybe the Romans weren't all bad. So I just love to hear more about kind of how you went about, you know, writing these characters and this story. Like, are there, you know, moments from myth that you wanted to keep in, or did you want to kind of mostly make it your own story using these mythological characters?
It's a hard one to answer, you know. Mm-hmm. My process of writing is messy.
Me too.
It's not like I start with chapter one and know exactly what's going to happen, you know. So it's a hard one to answer. I do go back and read the myth again so that I can maintain, you know, some association, some semblance of sticking to the myth. But I'm not religious about it. I care more about developing interesting relationships and dynamics in the story. In my career, I worked in psychology and social services and that sort of thing. And I just think for a contemporary reader to be interested in this, it has to resonate. So that's my permission to go wild.
Yeah. Well, I think, too, you picked characters that are perfect for that. Because, like you said, I mean, Circe really only appears in the Odyssey in terms of Greek sources. Yeah. And Scylla, as you know, as a non-monstrous form, doesn't really appear in Greek sources at all. And so you have so much permission to kind of to do what you want with it. And it just, yeah, it makes it much more interesting. I mean, it's I also love the characters where, you know, you get this little piece of them. And then you can kind of expand and make them into your own without, not that there's anything wrong with, you know, making changes to a myth that does have a more substantial character and history than someone like Circe. But it is so much more interesting to have this very open-ended kind of character like she is.
Yeah, yeah. And the other thing is, you know, myths, they have versions. To me, seeing all the variations gives me permission to create my own. I may be presumptuous, but that's what I do.
I think that's right. I mean, that's the thing. That's what makes them so interesting, too, is all the versions. It's something that I talk about a lot is, you know, the way that there is no right or wrong version. There's only, you know, this one came at this time and this one came at that time. And it's much more interesting to look at them, you know, for what they are in their individual forms and maybe look at why these things changed, you know, when they did. Like Ovid's Circe is really interesting. You can't, you know, comfortably say that that she's a particularly Greek character because he makes all of these changes. But of course, he's working off of the Greek. He's working off of the Circe and Homer, and he's doing basically what you did, you know, but he's Ovid. And so often I think people come at it and they think because Ovid's is really detailed that it must be, you know, the right or wrong version. Yeah. And of course, no, you know, and it's just, it's another version and it's interesting in itself, but it, you know, it's just kind of another take on the myths.
Yeah. And it probably reflects the issues of the time. You know, what was puzzling Ovid at the time he was writing it? He did it like we do. Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I often wonder too, you know, and I wonder if this is something you think about, is I wonder about all the things we don't have, you know, all the sources that don't survive and what they might have said. I think about that a lot when it comes to Ovid, because he makes all these, you know, he puts all these storylines into Metamorphoses that seem like they could be complete departures from the myths that we have. But it's very possible that a lot of the things that he writes are based in other sources that we don't have access to today. And that is just so much more interesting to think about.
How did he get from wherever to his time? Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. Did he make it up or did he read something that we'll never know existed? That's so much more interesting.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Did you consult a lot of sources beyond Homer and Ovid for this? I'm just curious kind of what you read and if you loved any of them, you know, even if they didn't make it into the book.
Yeah, for my second book, I was surprised to find that Xenophon had a lot of information about horses. How you choose a horse, how you train a horse, what do you do with a horse? And anyway, I used a lot of that in my second book. It's more current in my mind. Yeah. So I'm sorry, I'm skipping to examples that don't relate to Circe. But I read Apollonius, Ovid. What else did I read? The tragedies, you know? Mm. There's so much rich stuff. I wish when I had come to the point of choosing what to study, I would have studied the classics. But it's something I'm rediscovering now. And it's sweet. It's sweet. Mind you, to start writing, I took classes, Liv, right? And all my assignments I had to do in English, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I have collected a bunch of English. I don't work with original texts, which is a shame, but I'm kind of cut off from the ability to study and learn ancient Greek again and all that.
No, I was going to ask that as well, actually, what language you're often reading these sources in, because, I mean, it's something I face. I'm just very Canadian. And so I only know English, though I'm trying to learn modern Greek very badly. But I'm the same. Yeah, I love it. But I need to get better at it. But the, coming at them in translation is so interesting. And what I've found, because I've read, I try to read them in multiple translations so that I get, a little bit more out of the story, because I also never got the chance to learn ancient Greek. And so there are so many ways, though, that you can, kind of work around something like that. And yeah, it's fine in itself to read the English, and then you can just kind of play around with what you're reading or, which translations you're reading. So, which immediately makes me want to ask, do you have a favorite translation of Homer or the one that you've been using?
Fagan.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Nice and classic.
And, because I quote a little bit, I had to go back to Butler.
Me too.
Because I don't have to get permission, essentially.
Yeah. I read the entire Odyssey translated by Butler for the podcast for that exact same reason, because I could, because there's no copyright and I wanted to.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's always interesting, is, navigating those things as well. I do that all the time on my show. I'll quote little bits here and there on a podcast, because you're allowed on podcasts in a way that you're not in books. It's odd. But then whenever I want to quote something much longer, I find a public domain translation, and it's very old, but it's worth it because you still can quote a lot, and it's nice.
That's it. And you also, in comparing different ones, you see how much interpretation is part of translation. It's mm-hmm. amazing. I need to tell you, Circe is going to show up in Greek. I've translated it. Mm. I've just not chased anybody over there, a publisher, in other words, but I am fluent in modern Greek.
Yeah.
It's the ancient Greek that is like Chaucer here or whatever.
Yeah, that's such a good example, comparing it to Chaucer or even like Old English, mm-hmm. though I know, mm-hmm. I mean, ancient Greek at least shares some words with modern Greek, but then some are so different that you just kind of get lost entirely.
Yes.
I'm just, because I don't know any of them, I just am obsessed with what little I do know and the etymology between them. And then when I can find that link to English too, and I annoy my friends and family with it quite often, but it's very fun.
Well, my son and grandkids are trying to learn Greek. So we fall to etymology frequently, because if you know the basic root and the 20 some prepositions, you already have increased your vocabulary,
Absolutely. I mean, and it's so interesting the way they do, the certain words in modern Greek that are the same or similar in ancient. And then you can see where the English, often it's, scientific words in English, and you can see where they got that root from. Or, I was with my friend the other day, and I was explaining to her, she didn't ask, I don't know if she likes it, but I do it anyway, but I was explaining to her what the modern Greek words for man and woman are and how they relate to like anthropology and gynecology and just being a nerd. It's very fun.
Yes. Yeah. Sometimes I do that to the doctors, They think they know it all. Well, I got something on you.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, I'm also just I'm excited to talk to a Greek person. I really love the language so much, and I don't have enough access to it. But
I think you're brave in tackling Greek. It's such a complicated language. Sometimes, you know, I cannot analyze why the sentence needs to go that way. And it's not because of idioms. It's just complex.
Yeah, it is. I will say that. I'm very good at like individual words and very simple sentences. But as soon as someone speaks back to me, that's when all my knowledge of Greek leaves my head. It's not very helpful, but I'm hoping to take a lesson when I'm next in Athens. I'm going to really try, going to get in. But so, you know, is there anything that really stood out to you writing this as someone who is Greek and has this as your heritage and, you know, modern Greek being your language? Did anything stand out for you that you really wanted, you know, to make that into the book, or you felt really stood out because of your heritage?
You know, not to be grandiose, but what a better place than taking my heritage and offering it to readers here. You know, it's a privileged place. And I have a feeling for all these stories. I get into them. I mean, when my son was growing up, this may sound strange, but we talked about the ancient Greek pantheon, you know, and he was praying to Zeus. Does that sound odd?
No, a lot of people still do that.
The pagan. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And it was not because of that. It's no. Because we read myths, you know, bedtime and made up stories. And same thing with my grandsons. And in fact, they were a big part of my choosing to write about mythology, because they read, we talk, they tell me the latest, you know. And there is a lot of YA people that do author books for these age groups. So it's all around me. How can I help it?
Yeah, well, like I said earlier, too, I think it's so great that we are getting more actual Greek voices, you know, writing these retellings, because, you know, it's all well and good how many are written by Americans and British people. And I hope there's a Canadian in there now and then, but we're kind of quiet up here. But, you know, it's very often that these books are not written by people with Greek heritage. And I mean, there's a lot to be said about the way that modern Greece has often been separated from ancient Greece in the Western world. And it's something I like to draw attention to on the show, because I think it's incredibly unfair, but it's very common. And so it's an odd history, I'm sure, to have as your culture, because unlike most others, I would say, you know, Greek is become this thing that is seen as kind of, you know, the origin of all of quote unquote Western civilization. And it gets kind of taken away from the Greek people, whose history it actually is, you know?
No, we do. This is my way of claiming it.
Yeah.
This is my way of claiming it.
It's good. And I'm seeing more and more. I heard from you via your publicist and I was excited to talk to you. But then very shortly after, I heard of at least another two. One's a novel and then one was a short story. And I'm going to try to maybe put their names into the podcast later, because I don't remember them right now. But two more Greek people, Greek women who are writing retellings. And again, in English, because I think, of course, there's a huge place probably in modern Greek as well. But it's nice to have Greek voices amongst the English, because I think it's a good reminder to people reading in English that, you know, like Greek people can write about this stuff too and should.
Yes, yes, yes. And it's a pleasure in my author group, you know, when we are sharing pieces that we've written, you know, I get to tell them, oh, helix, Cilix, do you know what that means? You know, little insights, peplos, you know, clothing, yeah. Women, you know, porpi or whatever. Yeah.
It's so fun to do that. I do that. Yeah. As I said, often earlier, but I think a lot about My Big Fat Greek Wedding, if you watch that, and the grandfather who explains how everything is from Greek. And I realize how much I do that. And then I just embraced it recently of like, I'm not even Greek, but I'm going to tell you about how all of these words, you know, come back to the Greek.
Even kimono.
Yes. That was the one my friend referenced. I was like, yeah, no. Okay. That one's a joke. I get it. I mean, it's, you know, we don't want to give away spoilers, so I don't want you to, you know, have to dive in too deep about what the story is, but is there anything you want to share about the characters and kind of, you know, how you wanted to write them, things that might appeal to my audience or that you just want to share?
Let's see. I want them to have both positive, powerful, good attributes, but I also want them to have faults.
Mm.
And if you look at the subtitle of the book, you know, an unexpected ally, but then it's about love, revenge, and redemption.
Mm-hmm.
So that points out what emotions I'm trying to present and how people deal with those emotions. You kind of can sort the first word, love, because there is Circe about to lose her love, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to deal with that, you know, the aspect of loss, the aspect of yearning for another relationship and that sort of thing. And then you get the same sort of thing from the innocence, the younger, you know, the Scylla, who is, you know, just going swimming and having boyfriends, maybe choosing, being charming, all of those things. And then Glafkos, he is also a Greek character,
mm-hmm.
and not a very well-known one. And he has a magical story of from fishermen becoming a god.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, he has to live in, because he's protected by Poseidon, he's a sea creature. So you have the land and the sea, and
mm-hmm.
the environment gets highlighted quite a bit in this, you know, the natural settings. And there is other little myths, little stories that crop up. For example, the centaurs show up. Dionysus and, you know, his little host of characters and parties and all that. So it's all Greek. It's elements that get woven in there. I'm not sure what else to say without giving you more of the plot, you know?
No, that's great. I meant to ask about Glaucus earlier, because he is a very interesting character, like you said. And he does, yeah, he, you know, very similar to Scylla, aside from her monstrous form. It's minimal, you know, details that we get on him, but what we get is really interesting. So it's nice to be able to expand upon that and also write a story where the sea is important, because of course, you know, the sea in Greece is incredibly important and very relevant everywhere. So it fits nicely. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
Hi, I'm Michael Rappaport.
And I'm Kibi Rappaport.
And together we're hosting Rappaport's Reality Podcast.
We have a passion for reality TV, and we're inviting you into our living room.
We're talking tea, we're dissecting the drama, and we're giving praise to the single greatest form of entertainment on television today. That is right. Reality TV is the greatest form of entertainment on television today.
Here are some examples of what you'll hear from us on Rappaport's Reality Podcast.
This is where we discuss all things reality TV, all things popular culture.
And a little bit of Rappaport's reality, the reality of us.
We're figuring out. And if we had been recording these last 4 or 5 days, it would have been the podcast juicy. Would have taken a left turn.
Listen to Rappaport's Reality with me, Kibi Rappaport.
And me, Michael Rappaport, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcast.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season one, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do. Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season one, like my producer, Anna.
Oh, my God.
My friend, Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the deputy medical examiner.
And, of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure, it kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What?
I can't believe this.
Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV True Crime Podcast, To Live and Die in L.A. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world, and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene!
Eugene Fodor!
Gene, was booted!
Much of the joy you will find on the road comes from the person you share it with.
So you write the books, Gene. And last hour on the business. I understand now. It's a wise man who marries a wiser woman.
But be careful and choose your travel partner well, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
Get down!
I'm not stupid, Gene. Something is going on, and it's high time you tell me the truth.
Freeze, Americano! Huh? Oh!
Gene! Run!
So travel before it's too late. Your money will return, your time won't, and we're all too quickly approaching that final destination.
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, I'm excited to hear that Dionysus is in it because I do love him very much. I bet that was fun. Were there other gods or you know, including him, that you found particularly fun to write about?
Poseidon is in there in both books. I have Apollo meddling a little bit, you know.
He would.
Circe's mother shows up because that's a way of elaborating mother-daughter stuff, which will leave the reader interested in the next book, because that is all her story, Percy's story. There is a couple of just plain made up humans. Melis is a character that is a servant of Circe's and a very trusted servant. So it's a positive, you know, relationship between the god and the human.
Mm-hmm.
There is a fellow, again, made up, who lives in Delos, and he's a fisherman. And his name will give you a positive vibe because it's Ariston.
Oh.
So even the names, you know, that I choose, like Melis, it reminds you of Melissa. It reminds you of honey.
Yeah.
So it's that kind of persona. And I play with words like we all do when we write.
It's very
so
fun.
Those are some of the extras, you know, that show up to support the main cast.
Yeah, I just love hearing about all the gods, which is why I asked. I'm interested in how people write about the gods, you know, from this fictional perspective, because they're all so complex and open to interpretation. So, you know, mm-hmm. like I have kind of running jokes on the podcast about, you know, who the most dangerous gods are, you know, when it comes to women, because that's usually why they're dangerous. But even still, you know, like it's so interesting to hear how other people see these gods, because they're completely open to interpretation. You can see them in so many different ways. And I come at it from, you know, my very specific perspective. And I say that because I like to point out that in terms of the actions within mythology, by and large, Poseidon is one of the most dangerous gods when it mm-hmm. comes to being a woman.
Yes. Poseidon, a brother to Zeus. Yeah. You know, who is a sex maniac.
Yes. I mean, he's the obvious one, but Poseidon, there's something about what he does. It seems even more dangerous than Zeus, but Zeus certainly... has he's got a lot going on. It's just so fun to talk about them because there's just so much.
Again, in the second book, you know, there is scenes where gods are debating what to do or what's going on in the earth, and there's Zeus and there's Poseidon that takes a different tact, and there's a little battle going on between them and stuff. And it's exciting. It's juicy.
Yeah. Well, since you mentioned the other book again, because I'm so fascinated, that must be really interesting because, you know, in order to write about Perseus, you have to write about a Titan, right? Like, so beyond the gods, but also not quite as powerful because of the war. And, you know, did you, I don't even know what a question, I just am interested in writing about Titans, but like, what did you want to do with that?
You know, I do have Titans in the second book, and I'm not clean about not mixing the groups.
Yeah.
But the Titans are the generation that is gone,
mm-hmm.
and Zeus and company are the ones that are maybe a little more enlightened, but there is still things to do. So I kind of classify them by the role I assign to them.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, Yea shows up in the second book. Cybele shows up. It's such fun. We have such a rich playground of gods and goddesses, you know?
Oh, exactly. And the Titans are so interesting in the mythology because it is often seemingly arbitrary what makes them Titans versus a typical god. You know, like the Olympians, it's nice and clear what makes them Olympians, but everyone else, it's sort of random because, you know, every source had kind of a different idea in mind, and there was no rules, of course. There's no one deciding that, you know, this is how things function in Greek mythology. This just sort of 1,000 years of people writing these stories. And so,
right.
You get people that are technically Titans, but there's nothing about them that seems different from the gods. Yeah. It is such a playground, though, like you said, you know, there's so much there. And they are so interesting. And I'm sure you got to, if you're having, you know, the gods kind of bickering and arguing, the Iliad is such a great example of that happening. It would be fun to take what happens there and, you know, use that to inspire you for yourself. Like, we have all these different kind of little instances that you can use as inspiration to, you know, expand or write your own story with. Yeah.
Yeah, they have their preferences. They protect Hector, but hate whatever, you know.
Yeah. I mean, who doesn't love Hector? He's great.
He is, isn't he? Isn't he? He's quite a lovely spirit. Yeah.
He is. He's definitely, I like to say he's the best of the men in the Greek or in the
match.
Yeah.
And Cassandra, she's fascinating, you know. Such insights, and then they ignore her.
Yeah. Well, and she's interesting too, because there's like, you get this idea about her, and she's so famous, you know, for being this prophet for all these reasons. But in terms of like actual sources, no one really like dives into her story. No one really gives us all the details that we would want. And yet, you know, she remains this like really famous character.
Yes. Prime for writers.
Yes.
Yes, we can make that.
Yeah. That's why I my favorite characters for that. And I've been writing a book forever. We'll see if it ever gets finished. But it was about Cadmus and Harmonia.
Oh.
They are great examples of that, where we have this tiny little bit of their story and it's very important, but there are basically no details about it that survive.
Oh, I hope you get it done.
Oh, thank you.
You get it out.
One
How
day.
Long have you been at it?
Technically, since 2009. 2008. So it's been a little while. 15 years, I guess. Oh God, that's been a long time. It's a very different form now than it was back then. But now I spend all my time writing my podcast, so I have little time. But one day I'll finish it. The podcast is a good thing to spend my time on. Now, you said Cybele features in the next book, and I would love to hear anything that you want to say about her, because she's so interesting. I just recently did an episode on her for the show, because, you know, as this kind of Trojan style goddess, she's so interesting because she moved into Greece and then later into Rome and everything. So I mean, I don't even know if that's not a question. I just heard a name I love, if you want to talk about her.
Well, you know, I ran into her when I visited Aphrodisias in Turkey.
Ooh, of course.
And then I also ran into her when I visited the island of Chios, the Greek island, where there is, in the main town, there is an area that they call Homer's Rock.
Mm.
And it is a huge rock. And the story the guides tell you is he used to gather his students and used to teach them how to write epic.
Aww.
Right? That is Homer's Rock. And right underneath it was Cybele. They had found evidence of Cybele and the worship of her. So that's where I ran into Cybele twice. And, you know, it sticks. It
sticks. Well, I mean
going to museums and looking at statues, you get ideas about how they played music, you know, how they worshipped, how they did magic in the temples to impress, you know, the crowd and all of that. So physically, living in that space offers a lot. I'm changing the subject. I'm sorry.
No, no.
All the time. But it is going to the Acropolis Museum. You're going to find a lot of friends, you know.
Yeah. Absolutely. No, please feel free to change the subject to things like that. I'm more than happy. That's fascinating. I didn't know about that. I haven't been to Eos, and I need to. I mean, I need to go to all the islands. But yeah, I those moments are so meaningful, I think, especially as individuals, you know, going to these museums and seeing the artifacts For all I love the Acropolis Museum, the National Archaeological Museum in Athens is just like unbelievable and like life-changing, yeah. you know? Yeah. And even all the little archaeological museums in each city, you know, where you think like it's just, I mean, they're often like really low budget museums, but they've got some incredible stuff because there's just incredible stuff all over Greece. And so, even the cheapest looking museum has the most incredible artifacts in it. It's just amazing.
That's right. That's right. And you have, you know, I've had some of the better conversations just picking up a topic with the guides in there. They sit and watch and make sure everything is safe. They know so much.
Mm-hmm.
You know, watching teachers take kids through the museums, you know, and tell them about what they are looking at. And I've learned, I've had to make changes in Circe because I saw a picture of what a loom looks like.
Mm.
In my mind, I had the looms that we know today, four posts, you know, and all of that. Oh, no. They had them hanging with weights, and that was the one direction, and then they would weave through, you know, and I had to go back and edit that.
Yeah, I mean, that's wonderful that you got that opportunity too. It's funny, I don't think I ever imagined what the ancient looms looked like, but I've talked to enough archaeologists that I just know that a loom weight existed.
Yes.
But I'd never, you know, thought beyond knowing that that's a thing, you know, that they had. It's like the artifacts you end up kind of coming across if you go to enough museums, but often the context is left out, like how that actually functioned. So, mm-hmm. you know, the way you learned that and then were able to change the story so that it fit, you know, the more ancient functionality is just, it's really interesting. There's so many little bits and pieces like that.
Yeah. Yeah. To get a sense of their everyday life. I mm-hmm. mean, that it's such a gift, you know, it's such a gift. I love watching archaeologists explain how they piece things together, you know, tell me what they eat. You know, I have to write about a symposium. What will they serve? You know,
I mean, that's the best part about what my job with this podcast has become, because now over the last few years, I just talk to archaeologists and authors about their work like all the time, and the things that I've learned from having, you know, some archaeologists come on to talk about the most random little details of the ancient world that they know about, and it's all fascinating.
Yeah, it's really cool.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, this is so much fun. I just want to, you know, I want to make sure that we've talked enough about your characters, Circe and Scylla and Glaucus too. So fascinating. And then the book itself, but you know, I don't want to put you on the spot, but is there anything else, any other topic that you wanted to talk about from anything? Like if you want to start talking about museums again too, I'm fine with that. I just thought I'd ask.
Let's see. What do I want to talk about? I want to talk about this being a book with a message about the possibilities of connection. And how we can interpret and misinterpret intentions. So I just think it has value to think about these models, you know, because that's what these characters are, these models of how they approach life, how they falter, misinterpret,
mm-hmm.
and how they wake up. Oh, now I got it. It's about that kind of play. And it's definitely a feminist book.
Good.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a large part about why I wanted to have you on the show, because that was in the email. So why don't you tell me a little bit more about that? Like, you know, what about it did you want to be feminist? Like where were you coming from in wanting to have these kind of feminist elements in the book?
Well, we spoke about Homer and how he, you know, talks about women in a kind of, okay, they are useful because Odysseus is traveling, you know. They are not filled out. They are not heroic. They are not big. Poor Hera, you know, she's always jealous and munching at Zeus, you know. That's not what women are. So that was a good motivation for picking a glorious creature and having her do good in the world. She's thought to be evil. Not in my book. Not in my book. She's complex, but she is a do-gooder in the end. So that's how I come about it. You know, I'm not a feminist in the sense that guys are wrong, although they can be a little bit, or maybe more than a little bit in this book.
No, I think, I mean, that's the perfect way to come at it, though. You know, I think a lot of the time these days, especially, books are sometimes marketed as though they're feminist just because they have a woman as the main character. But I think, you know, there's more to it than that. And it includes giving these women agency and looking at their stories beyond what existed in these, you know, these versions, like you're saying, like Homer, where mm-hmm. the men wrote one thing. And, you know, I think when it comes to studying, and specifically not studying, I suppose, but reading about Greek myths as like any old person, you know, walking into a bookstore and picking up a book, more often than not, you're going to get one either, you know, ancient source or otherwise when it's written by a man. And really often these things are really biased, even when it comes to the ancient sources, you know, like, and the ancient sources were biased. But I think a lot of people then, and a lot of people defend this, and it's, you know, the entire point of my podcast, so it comes up very often, but people defend it as if, well, that's just the way things were back then. And it's like, no, that's just the sources we have. You know, and so I think it's so important to have Circe and take back this kind of character and give her a actual character and an actual personality. And
yeah, and then you have, you know, sources that talk about Aspasia, Pericles. You know, I mean, they existed. They just don't get the microphone often enough. So that's what we can do. We modern writers is get them to speak, to voice who they could have been or were. Who knows?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, that's, you've basically described why I run this podcast. That's me all the time. And I think that is so important. And it's also just interesting, you know, like it's important, but it's also just valid and valuable information. And it's, yeah, it's just interesting in itself. I actually, now that you mentioned Aspasia, I spoke with a scholar recently who's got a new book coming out on Phryne, the courtesan, or, you know, Hetera, if you want to call her that, who famously was supposed to have, you know, gotten naked in front of the Athenian courts in order to, you know, get herself off of a charge. And, you know, she probably didn't actually get naked in front of the court, but she did do some incredible things. And we have a lot of really fascinating sources about her, but often, you know, she's either not talked about or she's only talked about because there's a story where she got naked. And it's such a good example of the way women are. Even when we have sources about women, they're often still kind of, you know, made to be less important than the men, or, you know, I mean, the way that Pericles is so famous, and Aspasia, I think, is now becoming a bit more famous, but it's a long time for her to go to reach Pericles level.
Yes, exactly. Always secondary roles in support of guys. Enough.
Exactly. It's our turn. You've had it long enough. Well, I love that. That's wonderful. And Circe is, she's so complex. I think she comes across as evil in parts of the Odyssey, but then really not in others too. You know, she is really sympathetic and really interesting. And I find her to be one of the most interesting characters from Greek myth because she is a bit more complex than a lot of the women are presented.
Yeah, she was generous with Odysseus. She helped him, you know, talked about Tiresias and that you have to go get more advice before you try to go back home. She didn't have to do that. So that was an element of grace.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, she warned him. The only reason that Odysseus got anywhere is because of all the warnings she gave, right? Yeah. The warnings about Scylla and Charybdis and did she warn him about the winds too? Like, I feel like she gave him so many warnings and he screwed up most of them, but she tried really hard to help him.
Yes.
Yeah, it's wonderful. Well, I'm utterly thrilled that there is this novel coming out. An unexpected ally. So thank you so much for talking to me about it. It's been so much fun. And I love hearing all of this.
Liv, it is amazing. It's like just rattling off and connecting with another fanatic mythology person. I have enjoyed it thoroughly.
Oh, I'm so glad. It's really like, I do this every few days because I have so many guests on, and it's always this much fun because we're all big. We just love it. And it's so interesting and it's just my favorite thing. So thank you.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate the time you've given me.
Oh, you're so welcome. I'm so thankful. Thank you all so much for listening. I'm so thrilled to have these episodes. I'm so thrilled to have conversations generally, but particularly that I recorded a bunch before catching COVID. That has been an absolute savior. On Tuesday, I will be back with, I don't even know what yet, because all my scheduling went out the window, but I'm going to write a script and it's going to be great. And I'm pretty sure I'll be able to record it, which is all that matters. But for now, I really hope you enjoyed this. We had such a lovely chat. I love having authors on to talk about their books. I am trying to make sure that I really intersperse those with also just scholars talking about all the different topics from the ancient world that fascinate all of us so much. I've had a lot of authors recently because this is the season when all the books come out, but I am getting back to some of those roots of scholars and academics and archaeologists talking about the nerdiest stuff in the world, so stay tuned. We have so much more to come. You're all absolutely lovely. Thank you so much for listening. As always, Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is written and produced by me, Liv Albert. Michaela Smith is the Hermes to my Olympians. My assistant producer, Laura Smith, coincidence, I know, is now working with me on the podcast doing some audio editing. Oh my God, can you believe it? Someone who knows how to edit audio. And also working to bring the website into being something that is helpful and functioning. Could not be more happy to have Laura working with us. The podcast is hosted and monetized by iHeartMedia. Listen on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. For the first time ever, I am doing these credits from memory and it's going really well. Help me continue bringing you the world of Greek mythology and the ancient Mediterranean by becoming a patron. Visit patreon.com/mythsbaby or click the link in this episode's description. And patrons, if you are listening to this, you will have the bonus episode soon. COVID really took me out of everything. I am Liv, and oh my God, I love this shit so much. I cannot wait to work on the next episode and be back in working and mythologically nerdy functionality, if that makes any sense. I am Liv, and I love this shit.
Hi, I'm Michael Rappaport.
And I'm Kibi Rappaport.
And together we're hosting Rappaport's Reality Podcast.
We have a passion for reality TV, and we're inviting you into our living room.
We're talking tea, we're dissecting the drama, and we're giving praise to the single greatest form of entertainment on television today. That is right. Reality TV is the greatest form of entertainment on television
today.
Here are some examples of what you'll hear from us on Rappaport's Reality Podcast.
This is where we discuss all things reality TV, all things popular culture.
And a little bit of Rappaport's reality, the reality of us.
We're figuring out. And if we had been recording these last 4 or 5 days, it would have been,
juicy.
Podcast would have taken a left turn.
Listen to Rappaport's Reality with me, Kibi Rappaport.
And me, Michael Rappaport, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcast.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season one, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do. Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season one, like my producer, Anna.
Oh, my God.
My friend, Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the deputy medical examiner.
And of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure, it kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What?
I can't believe this.
Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV true crime podcast, To Live and Die in LA. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene!
Eugene Fodor!
Gene, we'll boot it!
Much of the joy you will find on the road comes from the person you share it with.
So you write the books, Jean, and last hour on the business. I understand now. It's a wise man marries a wiser woman.
But be careful and choose your travel partner well, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
Get down!
I'm not stupid, Jean. Something is going on, and it's high time you tell me the truth.
Freeze, Americano! Huh? Oh!
Jean! Run!
So travel before it's too late. Your money will return. Your time won't. And we're all too quickly approaching that final destination.
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.